with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 24th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, it's one of our famous vacation days where we're on vacation, but you don't have to be. We bring you all new interview, never heard before, pristine, still in the shrink wrap, full warranty involved, untouched, minted, in mint condition. Chloe Thurston, author of At the Boundaries of Home Ownership, Credit, Discrimination, and the American State. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, very important for you to understand that when we talk about discrimination, we talk about racism, we're not talking about just the legacy of slavery in this country, or we're talking about, or just the allowance of discrimination by the government. We're talking about active measures taken by the government in support of white supremacy, white dominance. That's just a fact. And it's important to understand the role that government has played in this in the past, because when we look at the context in which people are living in our society today, understand that it is a function of decisions our government has made in the past. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, but it's a history that people don't seem to be terribly aware of. People don't understand why they have certain benefits that other people don't have. And a big part of that is just they were given certain benefits. So I'm on vacation right now. Matt, where do you think you are right now? It's Wednesday.
I am back in Brooklyn, actually, from being in Los Angeles. So hopefully tan in Brooklyn.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh, how did the show go?
Excellent.
Yeah. Seriously?
Yep. We took Los Angeles by storm.
I heard it didn't go that good.
Sold it out. Sorry about the property damage, but.
And so how long were you out there?
From Friday to Tuesday.
Where'd you stay?
I don't want to. It's a hotel downtown.
A downtown hotel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know if it's technically downtown. It looks downtown to me.
Is it the Ace?
No.
Well, you're back now, so you don't have to worry about people coming and crashing your place.
Oh, that's true. It was no. I still don't want to.
Oh, you're nervous.
The Omni Hotel.
Ooh, the Omni. That's going out on Twitter in the future. People are going to be there. Wait a second. Is that, Brendan, is that where we stayed, the Omni, when we went out there for Politicon?
No, we stayed at the Marriott.
All right. I don't know why you're staying at the Omni. That is a completely Squaresville hotel.
Yeah, Expedia.com, I think.
Okay.
Or one of those types of things.
Folks, I should tell you, one of today's sponsors is Skillshare. Anyone who goes to skl.sh, /majority report 2, is going to get 2 whole months of totally free access to Skillshare's entire library of super quality online courses and tutorials. Skillshare is a vibrant online learning community, offers courses on everything from design to video editing, photography, business, technology, cooking, meditation, and everything in between. There are Skillshare courses for everyone. You're going to have no problem finding any courses that are going to be useful for you, both in your personal life and your professional life. If you want to sharpen skills that you already have, or you want to look into stuff that you don't know how to do, Skillshare has you covered. They have courses for entrepreneurs. They have courses on computer coding, web development, personal nutrition, learning new languages, Photoshop, branding, marketing. I don't think you can become a dentist, but probably learn how to manage small businesses. I to be honest with you, I don't know what I've been looking at, because every time, because I'm on vacation right now, and every time I'm on vacation, or I have a couple of it, I go on to Skillshare and I just check out stuff, because I always walk away with like one piece of knowledge that makes it worth it. And then I piece it together into a large array of knowledge that I do not then employ. That's probably got to do the one with procrastination. Figure that out. They have courses for entrepreneurs. Courses, like I say, Photoshop. You can get 2 entire months of free access to every single course offered by Skillshare by going to skl.sh/majorityreport2. Just think of everything you'll have at your fingertips for 2 whole months. Again, that's skl.sh/majorityreport2. I put a link underneath this video. If you're watching on YouTube or if you're listening, the link will be there. Check it out. So Matt's just got back from L.A. He's probably recovering, probably didn't sleep at all, went out and partied every night. When you go to L.A., Matt, is this your night, your first time in L.A., is it?
It actually is my first time in
You're
L.A.
You're kidding.
Yep, never been there.
What did you do?
It's
going to be interesting.
Some rooftop parties, I think.
Yeah, rooftop parties, sure.
Going to the beach, I know.
Really?
Yeah, my girlfriend's going to drag me out there. Do the pier.
Oh, wait, you're going out with your girlfriend?
Yeah.
Wait a second. Whoa. Hold on for 1 second. Wait a second.
Breaking a lot of news on this.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I didn't even know this. She's from New York, right?
Yeah.
So you guys went out together?
Right.
Still fighting? Still fighting from the trip? Or are you getting
No, I don't think so. Probably not fighting.
All right.
Yeah.
So she dragged you out to the beach. You didn't have a fight about that? Because you know it's going to take you an hour and a half to get there, right?
I've resigned to that, I feel like.
Traffic is a nightmare.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be nursing a lot of probably expensive Uber rides, but we'll see.
Oh, you guys, that's right. It's all Uber now.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you had fun, or I'm sorry that it turned out such a disaster. But that's the tricky part about not knowing. Today's show is being supported by Simple Habit. Simple Habit is a mobile app that provides a massive and diverse library of 5-minute guided meditations. And the Majority Report audience can try Simple Habit totally free for an entire week when you go to simplehabit.com/majority. Look, everybody knows the benefits of meditation. The hard part is just getting into a regime of doing it. Simple Habit has over 2,000 guided meditations specifically designed for different parts of your day. And for just about anything you might be dealing with. That's why they got the 2018 Google Play Award for Best Well-Being App, because they have guided meditations for mindfulness, for anxiety, for depression, when you're having trouble falling asleep, for procrastination, stuff for parents so that you can figure out how to just not blow your top at your kids, because they're driving me crazy. Not your kids, mine. They have meditations made specifically for when you're waking up or your lunch break or when you've just gotten home from work or when you're going to bed. Different people try to do different things with meditation. Simple Habit can cater to just about anyone. Doesn't matter what your goals are. Doesn't matter if you are an experienced meditator or a first timer. The variety of guided meditations on Simple Habit is what sets it apart. Simple Habit is available on iOS, on Android, and web browser. And the Majority Report audience can try it for free by going to simplehabit.com/majority. If you're watching on YouTube, check out the link there. If you're listening, check out the link in the podcast description. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Chloe Thurston about the boundaries of home ownership, credit, discrimination, and the American state. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Assistant Professor in the Political Science Department at Northwestern University and Faculty Fellow at the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University and author of At the Boundaries of Home Ownership, credit discrimination and the American state. Chloe Thurston, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so basically, we're looking at the mechanisms, I guess, of or the politics that have been beyond essentially the development of credit and specifically in one setting in terms of housing, but then just general credit over the course of the history of the country. And let's start back in the development of the of home ownership and of loans. We have in the past interviewed Richard Rothstein on the color lines, but your research delves a little bit more into the sort of the development of some of what he discusses.
That's right. So Richard Rothstein talks a lot about the development of the color line. That's the idea, the use of racial criteria in mortgage lending. I step back a little bit beyond that and ask the question, how did they come up with the criteria to determine safe lending from risky lending historically? Sort of why did race, and I actually talk about gender and things like class, like income and the type of job you have, why did those ever factor into one's credit evaluation, and then how did those change over time?
Yeah, and so let's go back and look at that development, because the United States, I guess in terms of like the industrialized world, went in its when it followed a different path in this regard, particularly in the context of housing. But start back. Like when did this process start? I guess, as it were.
Yeah. Okay. Well. Okay. So you really need to go back to the 1920s and to think about. So it started in the 1930s, but I think it's actually really useful to go back to the 1920s. And to think about how the sort of type of mortgage we have right now, 30-year fixed rate, low down payment, how it's actually kind of absurd. And its absurdity is clearer when you look back historically. So just think about this. Imagine that you want to buy a house. It costs many times your income. And so you go to a lender, a total stranger, and you say, I want to buy this house. I don't actually have the money to pay for it. But I will just give you some. I'll give you, 20% of what it costs. And I promise I'll repay you in 30 years. A lot could happen in 30 years, of course. And I would also like to pay the same interest rate despite the fact that economic circumstances should change too. So this is absurdly risky for most lenders to agree to.
Again, all right, let's really delve into that just a little bit because, I mean, it's been so normalized on some level that the absurdity doesn't quite jump out at you unless you sort of like sit for a moment with it and realize like, wait a second, 30 years, that's particularly in 1922, or in 1930s, we're talking that's half a lifetime. It's certainly, close to half an adult lifetime.
But
you go ahead. There's a lot of different things that could go sideways.
So right before that, though, the normal time that you would have to repay a loan would be like 2 to 12 years. And on average, it was 5. So to go from 5 years to 30 years almost overnight is pretty remarkable. And I think you've sort of hit the nail on the head there.
And what was the impetus? I mean, I understand. What was the impetus to changing that in the and when exactly did that change?
So this changed in, if I could choose any year, I would say 1934, which was the year that Congress passed the National Housing Act, and this created the Federal Housing Administration, which created a loan insurance. So basically, private lenders now could apply for insurance from the federal government against the default of a loan that they were to give out, provided that loan had really long loan terms, required a low down payment, and had a low interest rate. And so that actually came about because of the Great Depression, because there was massive construction unemployment, and FDR and his advisors thought that one way to solve that unemployment crisis would be to make it easier for people to buy houses and to rehabilitate houses they already had. Again, you know, we're in the midst of this massive economic crisis, and so there's just not a lot of lending that's going on. There are a lot of homes that are in need of repairs, but people unable to finance that.
So there was not a decision to say we want to create this product, a 30-year mortgage. There was
no.
There was a context here. We have massive unemployment, particularly in the construction trade. We're convinced that home ownership will drive and spur the economy, and we know that banks are afraid to loan. So we're basically just going to insure and backstop those bank loans, and that's the development of the FHA and Fannie Mae. Tell us, I guess Fannie Mae comes in 38, but tell us what. You know, be more explicit as to like what Fannie Mae is, and what was the anticipation? Was just that there's going to be a bunch of different mortgage products, or what?
So the idea with the FHA first was that there would be one, and so it's now the sort of what we have, and most people actually don't apply for an FHA loan, but the type of loan we have is modeled after that. And, you know, now we have a 30-year, 20% down payment mortgage. But at the time, it was closer to 20 years. It's gradually, the amount of time people had to repay increased until it became 30 years. And it started off as 30% down payment. But the idea was to, yes, have this one standardized mortgage. The reason for that was that, you know, if the federal government was going to insure everyone's mortgages, it would be much easier to do that if they all conformed to the same criteria. Otherwise, it's really difficult for the government to make sure that the Treasury isn't on the hook, because how do they appraise, you know, whether or not the lenders are acting in a safe or risky way? The other issue, and you asked about Fannie Mae, so I'll answer that, is so it's not enough, and they realized it wasn't enough at the time to just say, well, lenders will insure you, we, the federal government, will insure you against the default of your mortgages, because this, again, was a big change in the sense that lenders were accustomed to getting their loans repaid in maybe 5 years. And so if you're a lender and you give someone a loan that they are going to repay over 30 years, that's a very long period of time that you're waiting for that money to get repaid to you. You know, that's 30 years before it's fully paid off. And so lenders might be reluctant to do that because it ties up their money in ways that make it difficult for them to act in the future. So the idea of Fannie Mae then was to create this sort of facility where that would buy off all of the outstanding loan debt that lenders lent out, and then that would free up more money so lenders could keep extending these loans to more and more people.
So this is, I mean, essentially, it's a derivative, right? I mean, on some level, or is this like I guess an early derivative?
I think that's a fair way of looking at it. Yeah. It's a secondary market. It's an early one because it's a really, really standardized one. All of the loans look the same. If you think about the way that derivatives were described in the wake of the financial crisis, you know, you had sort of pools of assets that had varying degrees of risk associated with them, lots of different types of loan terms. And in this case, the product itself was very standardized. But yeah, that's exactly right.
Okay. And so we set this up, and then where does – so this seems a fairly, you know, straightforward, I guess, to a certain extent. We have relieved the banks of and the lenders of the risks associated with a 30-year time horizon, and we have made it housing more attainable, I guess, for the average citizen. And let's just stop. I guess maybe here is a good time to sort of look at the other potential paths we could have followed, right, in terms of like what we see in Europe in the way that housing is supported there, or a government might have driven economic activity within, even as housing as a catalyst.
So, you know, I think Europe's a good comparison. And a lot of the housing reformers in the early 20th century and sort of the years before the Great Depression visited different European capitals and cities and countries to try to get a sense of other paths. And yeah, so, you know, I think the one sort of obvious path is to promote public housing or social housing. In the U.S., the public housing program was very small and it was means tested. So it was always intended for sort of the poorest of citizens who couldn't buy housing on the market. There were caps placed in the legislation at the time, also sort of cutting or there were costs, ceilings on the cost of the housing and the types of construction and building materials that would end up being available. But, you know, some countries have public or social housing that's not means tested. So you could be middle class, you could be a professional, and you could also live in social housing. So that's one path, though, is to promote sort of public rentals. You could also promote private rentals. And, you know, I think that I really think that the road not taken, though, in the U.S. was the cooperative housing model. So to have sort of limited dividend cooperations that are cooperatives that sort of don't have the same opportunities for profit maximization that the sort of single family homeownership model that the U.S. ultimately pursued had.
Yeah, tell us, I mean, it tease that out for us, because I don't think most people have an understanding of what that would look like in reality.
Well, so, you know, you can have, for example, a medium-sized set of condos where everyone who lives in the condos owns the condos and some sort of common stake in the common areas, but where that was not financed sort of through market speculation in the same way that sort of developers build single-family houses, you know, in a single development with the idea that they'll be able to sell all of those and maximize profits.
Right. Okay. So, so there's restrictions on its on its transfer, and I mean, it's probably not
exactly
too different than co-ops that exist today in New York, except for
that's right. Yeah.
There's more limitations on the liquidity of it. In fact, there are forms of housing in New York City that exist that are for purchase, but you cannot, they're capped in terms of what you can sell them in terms of return, like the,
that's right.
like a 7% maybe increase in value or something like that. So they're not investments as much as they are relatively inexpensive places to live.
That's right. And New York was sort of the model of, was sort of like the center of this cooperative model that just never took off. It was something that organized labor was actually in favor of in the 1940s, but again, it just didn't take off in sort of policy, in the history of public policy.
All right, and just so that people know, when we talk about socialized housing, you know, that is universal in the sense that it's not means tested. What does that mean? The government owns buildings and rents them out at some type of like, I don't know, maybe it doesn't make sense to say market rate, but at some rate that is more affordable to people. Is that basically
it? That's pretty much what it means. That's basically it. And, you know, in the U.S., by government, it doesn't necessarily mean the federal government. In practice, it means local housing authorities. But, yeah, it's the government owns the housing and rents it out at a rate that is considered affordable, which usually means below market rate.
Okay, so we set up that we head down this path, and then what happens that the ideas of race, in particular in the context of housing, enters in, and this system becomes a mechanism in which to discriminate?
Well, so as I mentioned before, the adoption of a long-term fixed-rate mortgage is very different than what lenders were traditionally used to. And so this is absurdly risky for them to get involved in. And now the federal government's involved, too, because it's saying, well, we're going to insure those loans against default. And so it puts the government in this position of suddenly having to figure out what types of loans would be too safe to would be safe enough to insure, and which ones would be too risky that they, you know, they shouldn't they should try to avoid these at all costs, because it's going to put the Treasury and ultimately the taxpayers on the hook if something goes wrong. And so they set out to develop a set of standardized underwriting criteria. And so several of the criteria that emerge end up being related to race. So, for example, the Federal Housing Administration's underwriting manual had very explicit instructions that the underwriter make sure that the neighborhood, the house was, and the neighborhood was protected from, quote, inharmonious racial elements. And so that meant that things were sort of in place to make sure that the neighborhood was not diverse and that it would not be at any risk of becoming diverse in the future, on the belief that this would affect the value of the house in the future. And then if the value of the house were to go down because the neighborhood were to change composition, that the government would be exposed to that risk.
And so it was basically just, this was not an unintended consequence, right? This was, we have
oh, no.
a racist society, and if we're going to subsidize essentially the construction of homes, albeit as a, you know, backstop on loans, we don't want to increase risk, and so we need to, I guess, reinforce that racism as a way of making sure we don't lose money.
Yeah, that's exactly right, and you know, they don't really see it as racist, you know, as we do at the time. They see it as, well, this is just what the housing market requires. You know, it's the sort of explanation is that, well, houses are sort of, we've studied neighborhoods that have more diversity or more racial minorities tend to have lower housing values. There was this correlation. And so therefore, in order to protect sort of all real estate going forward, we need to take, you know, we need to sort of embed that understanding into the way that we evaluate mortgage applications.
How much consciousness was there about, I mean, you know, obviously, you know, we look back on it, it sounds horribly racist to us. But how much of that awareness do you think was there at that time? Because, you know, we can see a on some level an analog in Social Security, right? And that was
right.
And that seemingly seems to have been a much more, I mean, in both these instances, we're not talking about unintended consequences. But in Social Security, at least my understanding of it was that that was basically a horse trade. Like, you know, we're going to get this as long as we exclude jobs that are that tend to be filled more by people of color and by women and by recent immigrants on some level, right? I mean, that was almost an explicit horse trade at that time. Was that an element in this instance, or was it just simply like, this is the way we mitigate risk? We just don't, people don't, you know, white people don't want to buy houses in black neighborhoods. Hello? Hello?
Hello.
Hi. Sorry. I don't know. Somehow
Hi,
I lost.
Hi. Sorry.
It.
I don't know what happened.
Did you?
So I have no idea what just happened. I think the call just dropped.
Okay. That's okay. Did you, what was the last thing you heard me say?
Oh, so you were asking about Social Security and sort of
right.
the comparison.
Right.
And you know, that's a great question. And you know, because the outcome is the same, right? You have a policy with Social Security that excludes domestic workers and agricultural workers, essentially African Americans and women. And in housing, you have, a program that excludes African Americans from homeownership. Actually, a very different history, though. So this wasn't something that was traded during hearings. There's no mention of race or anything that would even be sort of considered racially coded at the time during hearings for during congressional discussions of housing. This is all stuff that comes in rather dispassionately when bureaucrats set out to write all of the rules to administer the program. And it's just kind of, a foregone conclusion that, of course, neighborhoods are going to need to be sort of racially homogenous in order for houses to be considered safe. That said, I think that should be contrasted with the very explosive issue that housing and any sort of effort at desegregating neighborhoods faced at that time, too. We're still talking about periods where, would-be Black homeowners are intimidated, including violently, from moving into neighborhoods that are all white. So there's a total dispassionate racial discrimination ends up in housing in a very sort of closed way. It's dispassionate, but discrimination at the time and still in many ways today, if you depending on how you think about how the issue is covered now, can be very explosive when you're actually talking about how homeowners react to neighborhood diversity.
Right. And I know on some level, when we talk about today, we're getting into the topic, I think, of your next book. But so and I want to sort of stay here with this and the implications, of course, of this dynamic that started there have massive implications that are exponential in terms of what it means for the growth of wealth amongst people of color, right? I mean, because this is the way that this is the biggest driver of the accumulation of wealth across across income spectrums is value in home ownership.
That's right. It's across income spectrums, but particularly for the middle class, it's a family's largest asset is their house. And this is a way to pass down wealth through generations. And I think that's one of the areas where you see the racial wealth gap compound is that, if your grandparents were able to own a house, then they can pass down that housing wealth to their kids, and then they can pass that down to their kids. It makes it easier if you have wealth to draw on to purchase a house in a, quote unquote, more desirable neighborhood where you might be able to build equity faster. You see this today. And for example, the Boston Fed did a study of racial wealth gaps in U.S. cities a couple of years ago and found that the average African-American family in Boston had $8 in net worth, while the average white family had $250,000. And so I think that's a pretty stark example of sort of the difference in wealth that can happen when you are or that can occur when you're one group of people is excluded from access to homeownership for generations.
And so when does this dynamic change, or does this dynamic change?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, so, I start to see there's almost two questions in a way. So the practice of using race to determine whether or not houses are the race of a neighborhood or the buyer, whether or not to insure these houses, starts to get challenged almost as soon as the FHA is operational. The NAACP detects this just a few years after the FHA is in operation and starts to chip away at it. They point out, one, that there's actually not any evidence to say that neighborhood diversity causes houses to decline in value. This is all correlation, and there's a lot of reasons for why that correlation could exist that are social or not economic. And so they get the FHA to remove that criteria. They also prevail in sort of a broader issue, which is restrictive covenants. I know you said you had Richard Rothstein on your program, and he talks a lot about those in his book, but basically language in your mortgage deed that said that you agreed and future buyers agreed not to sell the house to members of undesired races in perpetuity. And so the NAACP launched a legal campaign that was ruled unconstitutional with Shelley versus Kramer in the late 1940s. There are all of these different things that happen to remove race as an explicit criteria that federal lenders and also private lenders can use, culminates in the Fair Housing Act in 1968. The problem, though, is that we are still living with the legacy of these earlier policies. And we still find a lot of evidence, too, that even though it's illegal to discriminate on the basis of race, race still factors in often and into sort of the terms of people's loans even today.
And we saw certainly in the wake of the financial crisis that African Americans were put into subprime loan conditions when, in fact, they qualified for perfectly typical, I should say, loans. At the folks were driven into these loans that had much more onerous conditions. All right. Well, so let's just jump over to the other story that you tell about women's. How mortgage laws and credit were applied to gender differences. I mean, I am old enough to have been alive at a time where my mom couldn't even own a credit card, I think, in her own name.
Yeah.
Which is just completely bat crap crazy as far as I'm concerned. But but that was the case as late as the early 70s.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, in a way, this is kind of similar. It's part of the same story that I was telling before, where, the federal government gets involved in making it easier for people to become homeowners, but then they have to figure out what would make one safe and what would make one risky. And so gender ends up inscribed into these rules. And the main belief is that, if you're lending to someone for 30 years, you better make sure they can repay it over 30 years. And you want to make sure that their income is stable. And so the issue here was that women's income was considered suspect. It was something that was considered to be temporary. Maybe she would have a baby and leave the workforce. And it was supplemental, sort of, her to buy her own personal enjoyments. It wasn't the family's income, though. And so this ended up inscribed into the lending criteria, though. So one thing that lenders would do, and that both the VA and at a time the FHA suggested or required, was discount a woman's income. So, you know, if she's working, well, can we really consider this income to be an actual income? Maybe we should just count 50% of the income on the mortgage application, since it's inherently less stable and reliable than a man's income. Another thing that lenders would do is say that a woman said, well, no, my income does need to be counted. I plan on working, the whole time that this mortgage is in effect. Well, the lender could say, okay, well, in that case, we're going to need a letter from your gynecologist saying that you're on the birth control pill. This was considered good business practice. It wasn't discrimination, or if it was discrimination, it was in the sense that, all lenders have to discriminate in the sense that they can't make bad bets, right? That will eventually put them out of business. And so this was considered good discrimination. They did this openly. This was a completely legal and good business practice up until the mid-70s when it was outlawed.
Okay. In this instance, there was no government sort of backing of this situation. This was just simply private lending institutions being able to use criteria that was really, I mean, in some respects, more superstition than anything else, but also horribly discriminatory.
Yeah. So yes and no in terms of government backing. So by this point, the Federal Housing Administration had sort of, in the past, it had criteria about sort of how to treat a wife's income or sort of what you could and couldn't do with it. And so by the 70s, they'd sort of stepped away from this. They didn't really mention very much. They said actually that it's either an all or nothing thing. So a lender shouldn't discount a wife's income, but he could decide to choose to count none of it. Or all of it. The VA, the Veterans Administration, which ran the GI Bill's housing programs, was a lot more strict about a working wife's income, and so actually did have requirements about how to count it and sort of directives about not counting a wife's income. One of the other issues was that Fannie Mae was at the time developing new criteria for its loans, for the loans that it was willing to back on the secondary market. And there, they were starting to come up with criteria that, while they didn't mention gender explicitly, would definitely or would most likely have affected women disproportionately. So income that was received from part-time work would be counted differently from income that was received from full-time work. Alimony wouldn't count as income, even if it's something that was guaranteed. There's a question of sort of whether like a Social Security type payment might count or might not count. So there was some government involvement in these terms, but I would say most of it really was happening in the private sector at this point. And the lack of any sort of explicit instruction not to discriminate on the basis of sex was what allowed that to persist, along with, like you mentioned, the sort of superstition surrounding women's income. It wasn't actually the case that they were less likely to repay at this time.
To the extent that activists in National Organization for Women were able to push back on this sort of in a similar fashion as activists were working behind the scenes, you know, to roll back some of these FHA problems. Was that more successful in terms of its durability? Like, for instance, are women, broadly speaking, are they less subject to these discriminatory practices in terms of credit today than, let's say, people of color generally? Or is that too tough to disaggregate because the legacy of the prior discrimination impacts current discrimination more?
That's a great question. One I haven't been asked in quite those terms before. If you look at, so there sort of is a legacy of discrimination that follows women trying to get access to credit. But if you look at sort of the extra price that women pay sort of on average for mortgage credit, it pales in comparison to sort of like the loss in wealth that African American and other families of color faced after the financial crisis. The cost of taking getting a subprime loan, even if you were qualified for a prime loan. So it's not the case that there are cases still of women having sort of difficulty getting access to mortgages on the same terms as men. There's been some research that suggested that they get slightly worse loan terms, but when they've actually sort of calculated out what that means, it could mean $80 to $800 over the course of a loan, which, I mean, that's not no money, obviously, but that's a much smaller amount of sort of possible wealth that's foregone than many families of color have faced over the same time. So there's a legacy, but I think that the policy movement was much more successful with women. I think we don't even really talk about the time when women couldn't have credit cards, right, as you mentioned before. Whereas this sort of the history of redlining and discrimination is something we're talking more and more about. And I think it's not just because the policies themselves didn't work as well as activists had hoped, but that there's just this longer legacy that's been much more insurmountable than the gender gap ended up being.
All right. So lastly, let me ask you this. Is this a story of government coming into a market and creating discrimination, or was it is the scandal here, to the extent that, for a lack of better term, and maybe I just don't have the academic terms for this, but is the story more about that these type of discriminatory actions, they existed in the private market, and then they were edified in the by government, and that that was a reflection of what was happening in the private market. Or is the story that government came in and basically this discrimination existed, but government came in and sort of allowed for greater inequality because it allowed access to some segments of the population and not others?
Can I say all of the above?
Sure.
The government, it's hard to say the government created discrimination, for the reasons that you point out. This was something that was prevalent in the private sector before. But one of the things that I argue in the book is that there's something different about putting the government's imprimatur on this, right? So now this is a practice that was reasonably widespread, but not codified in the way that the government policy made it. So that, I argue, it gave it a sort of staying power beyond what might have happened if the government hadn't gotten involved in quite that way. So you could think of a few things. One is that, there was a lot of racial discrimination in housing markets, but there were also lots of people who were happy to live in diverse neighborhoods and actually wanted to. And so it was very difficult for those people to get any sort of credit for building housing developments that were, the term they used then was mixed race. And so, in that sense, the government made it impossible for people who actually, envisioned living in diverse neighborhoods to do that. So it closed off those options. And then it also made it difficult to respond to changing ideas about the role of diversity in house values. So one of the things that I talk about in the book is the development of that idea, this idea that diversity undermines future house prices. This was something that appraisers at the time were sort of playing around with, but they also recognized that sort of appraisal itself was an imperfect science. It was a young one. They weren't actually sure what the nature of value was. When the government got involved in this way, though, it sort of ossified some of these ideas that were still in their nascence. It's possible that
it became default in some way.
It became the default, and it persisted for a long time because of that. It's possible that the private sector might have actually become even more racist in its thinking about real estate without the government's involvement. I'm not saying that that outcome might not have been possible either, but the government made it sort of last for a very long time, and it made it hard for people who didn't actually want to live in these types of neighborhoods to pursue housing through its means. So I do think that it had a legacy in those two different ways.
The book is At the Boundaries of Home Ownership, Credit Discrimination in the American State. We will put a link to this at majority.fm. Chloe Thurston, thank you so much for your time today. Fascinating stuff.
Thank you so much, too.
Let's take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice was made for the option where you don't get paid. shifted in and out.